This morning we continue on with the theme of imitating God's generous love in our dealings with other people. In this series, I've been highlighting, in particular, how we are to be over the top, going well beyond the norm, far more than the extra mile, and everything from serving others to demonstrating hospitality to showing forgiveness and so on. Even Michael Spencer's sermon on loving your enemies this past September fits squarely into this overall exhortation to be as generous and charitable and large-hearted as God is. He who is kind to the wicked and ungrateful has called us to do the same. Even though sermons on this charge to imitate God's love could go on indefinitely, I'm actually close to finishing up what I had planned on this particular subject. I only have two more areas to cover. One of those I'll tackle this morning. The last one will be addressed at the beginning of January. And after that, we'll be moving into something altogether different. For today, I want to talk about generosity and showing compassion. Throughout this series, I've been stressing that love is primarily an action, not a feeling. And that's something I kept hammering on because the commonly held views of love in our modern culture tend to emphasize more the subjective side, that love is a warm and sentimental feeling. But as you know, in the scriptures, love is primarily portrayed as selfless, sacrificial action in order to benefit another. And this, of course, is the example of love we see in God sending His Son to offer Himself as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. That said, we don't want to overreact and completely disregard the subjective side of love. God did not design us to be stoic, emotionless Vulcans. Feelings are not always unwelcome distractions that are in the way. Emotion, a gift of God, is not to be viewed as a nuisance. True biblical love, the love of God Himself that we are called to imitate, is not without feeling. God is a God of compassion and has called His people to be compassionate as well. Now, the message today is not about affirming emotion or trying to get us in touch with our inner feelings. We'll save that for another time. The subject is compassion, and while compassion in its truest sense goes well beyond feelings, it does, however, most certainly involve an emotional element. Now, I have divided today's sermon into two parts. In part one, I will define compassion, point out that God is the Father of compassion, consider various scripture passages that exhort us to be compassionate, and provide some common examples on how to implement those exhortations. Part one will be somewhat basic, providing a general overview of the subject, and will be useful in setting things up for part two. In part two, which I'll cover today as well, I'll be focusing in on one specific example, an area that we are all involved with from time to time. Some folks do quite well in it, others, well, not so much. It's the sort of thing that needs to be addressed from time to time, and so I'll be sharing a list of suggestions on how we can be a bit more sensitive and compassionate in this particular area. All right, well, in both the Hebrew and Greek, the word compassion literally means a gut feeling for the needs of others. In the ancient world, the bowels were regarded as the seat of one's emotions, in particular, those emotions that produce this warm, tender feeling we have when we see someone suffering. Throughout the scriptures, the word compassion is also translated as pity or tenderness, and also as mercy or tender mercies. Well, simply put, compassion is a feeling with and for others. We might think, for instance, of the word sympathy, which tends to stress the idea of being sensitive to another person's hardship, feeling pity for them, grieving because they grieve. We might also think of the word empathy, which stresses something slightly different, the sharing of the same feelings. Your father passed away. I loved your father as well. He was my best friend. In this, we share the same grief. Sympathy is feeling for someone. Empathy is feeling with someone. Compassion is the next step. It is a sympathy with help or empathy with help. Coupled with the feelings is some sort of action by which to console the person, offer comfort, or if possible, provide relief from the hardship itself. The supreme model of compassion is, of course, God Himself. He took pity on our hopeless situation, and that pity compelled Him to act in a selfless, sacrificial way. Throughout the Psalms, we are told that God is compassionate and gracious. In fact, this is why Jonah did not want to go to Nineveh. He actually complains to God about God's compassion, knowing that God would extend grace to Jonah's enemies if they were to repent, and he did not want that. In the Gospels, we read how Christ had compassion on the crowds, and because of that compassion, healed the sick and ministered to their various needs. The prophets and other Old Testament saints were deeply aware of this wonder of God's mercy to sinful men. They taught that anyone who had understood this or experienced this would feel that it would be his duty to have the same compassion toward others, especially the orphans, widows, and foreigners. The basic principle of Christian ethics is that those virtues which have been characterized by God's dealings with mankind are to be internalized by his followers and exemplified in their lives. And this is why Paul exhorts us, for instance, in Ephesians and Colossians. He says, chapter 4, 32 of Ephesians, "Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you." And in Colossians 3:12, "Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience." Peter weighs in on this as well in chapter 3, verse 8, "Finally, all of you, be like-minded, be sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble." And John, in his first letter, chapter 3, verse 17, "If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity or compassion on them, how can the love of God be in that person?" And we have this verse from Zechariah, which we could say pretty much represents the admonishments of all the Old Testament prophets. Zechariah 7:9, "This is what the Lord Almighty says, administer true justice, show mercy and compassion to one another." The parables of the Good Samaritan, the unmerciful servant, and the sheep and goats are all classic examples of Christ's teachings on compassion. The verse that always comes to my mind, though the word compassion is not mentioned in it, is found in 1 Corinthians 12. Paul says, "All the parts of the body should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it." And very similar to that, Romans 12:15. "Rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn," and Galatians 6:2, "Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ." There would, of course, be numerous ways on how to implement the basic charge behind all of these different passages. I won't take time to lay out an exhaustive list, but a few examples would be in order. Think of those going through a difficult time of sickness, perhaps an extended stay in the hospital or confined to a bed at home, feeling lousy, suffering pain. Well, cards of encouragement, flowers, short visits, or phone calls would certainly be in order. We go beyond having mere feelings of sorrow for them. We act on those feelings by providing some tangible way of offering comfort or relief. And in this, we are, of course, imitating God, who is the Father of all compassion. Another example would be someone who has lost their job, going through discouragement, fearful of his or her ability to make ends meet. Or think of those who lose everything they own in a fire or a tornado or flood or other kind of disaster. Divorce is another one. These experiences are always emotionally draining. There are ways to help bear some of that agony without being forced to take a side. Again, compassion is feeling with and for others and helping them get through a particular hardship. You know, I may be quite disgusted with a friend who was arrested for a DUI and is looking at a month in jail, but that doesn't mean that I can't show some compassion in this dark time that he's going through. Now would not be the time to turn my back. This charge to feel with and for others, you know, really isn't that hard to do when the one suffering is a victim of circumstances beyond their control. But are we not also obligated, as fellow sinners, equally in need of God's mercy, to stand with a brother or sister in the messes they make from their own failings? Oftentimes these are the most painful to endure and the most lonely, and where our compassion and help is most needed and can be the most effective. Paul's command to suffer with those who suffer isn't saddled with qualifiers. It's pretty much an unconditional kind of thing. And it's not limited to those who have a certain knack or gift or ability for this sort of thing. His exhortation applies to those who are more on the warm and sensitive side and to those who aren't so much. All right, well, with these thoughts in mind, let's now move on to part two. There is another example of showing compassion that I want to spend the rest of my time this morning addressing, and it is one we all face from time to time, and it is this, that of offering comfort to someone grieving the death of a loved one. This came up in one of the New Testament passages we looked at a few moments ago in Romans 12. Paul calls upon his readers to be devoted to one another in brotherly love and follows that charge with a chain of exhortations on just how to do that. And about halfway through that list, he includes this: mourn with those who mourn. If there is ever a time to feel with and for someone, it would, of course, be in this. There is nothing that can be compared to the anguish and pain of losing a close family member or a close friend. And when those in our lives go through such times of intense suffering, generosity and compassion is especially called for. Now, we all know this to be true. We don't need a sermon to convince us of that. And so what I would like to do here is offer some practical suggestions on how to best minister that compassion. And these suggestions, well, I didn't get them out of a book or anything. They are based on my own experiences with grieving families and on observations I've made of those who have attempted to offer comfort. Good examples and some not so good examples. Unfortunately, many people do end up doing more harm than good. They mean well, but quite frankly, they just lack some wisdom on this. And I just have to assume that there are lots of people who simply haven't had any guidance or instruction on anything along this line. And I would say that that would be true of me as well. I've kind of had to learn it along the way. Well, the best way to work through these suggestions is to set up a scenario that we can apply them to, and then obviously you'll be able to adapt these suggestions and principles to other situations as needed. And so the scenario I have in mind is goes something like this. There's been an unexpected death, actually a tragedy. A 12-year-old boy has been killed in a car accident. The grieving family are not close friends to you, but yet they are a part of the same church family. And the setting itself is the visitation at the funeral home the night before the funeral service. You've been in line for quite some time, and now it's your turn. This scenario offers a good working example for the particular points I want to press for today. Also, before I get into these, let me take a moment to say that there is never a good time to talk about something like this. Addressing anything related to death and grieving is going to hit close to home for at least some people, whenever such a sermon would be given. For instance, I am aware that Harvey and Patricia are grieving the unexpected loss of Katie, who passed away just 4 months ago. Eric's mom, less than a month ago. Fact is, each of us here faced the possible death of a loved one at any moment. And so in trying to plan out when would be a good time to give this sermon, mindful of that possibility, well, it was impossible to plan a good time. Essentially, I reason that the benefit of sharing these points today, as I had planned to do so for quite some time, outweigh the benefit of waiting for that perfect time, which probably will never exist anyway. All right, I have a list of 9 common sense suggestions, guidelines to share, and these are not necessarily in any particular order, and they are based on common sense. In fact, I actually hesitated to even put them forth, given how obvious that they are, but I'm compelled to do so nonetheless because of what I have witnessed firsthand through the years, and not necessarily by any of our folks here. Actually, I'd kind of like to help keep it that way, but I have observed these sorts of things. And perhaps those who might actually benefit the most would be those who are among our younger members. Again, the scenario is this. A 12-year-old boy was killed in a car accident. We'll call him Jimmy. You know the family. They are members of your church, but you would not necessarily consider them to be close friends. Well, first on the list is this. Do go to the time of visitation, which is generally held at the funeral home. In my scenario here, the grieving families are part of your church, and therefore there shouldn't be any debate in your mind about this. We are all brothers and sisters of the same body who are called to love, encourage, support, comfort, and minister to each other. And if there is ever such a time for that, it would be this. And this is what a church family does. We belong to each other. I mean, that's exactly what the New Testament says. We belong to each other. And all those verses about suffering with those who suffer and mourning with those who mourn are directed toward the members of a local community of faith on how they are to relate to each other in such hardships. Now, people tend to make the call on whether to attend the visitation or not on how close they are to the family or how close they are to the one who died. This is a common thing. We all do that. But I would argue that if you are part of the same church, then you are, by that fact alone, close. You have a unique bond with them, whether it is actually experienced in your social interactions outside of Sunday or not. All right, now while we are on this, let me just offer a couple other related suggestions as a rule of thumb sort of kind of thing here regarding attendance at visitations and funerals. I would propose that you attend the visitation anytime a fellow church member suffers the loss of either a parent, a sibling, or a child. A parent, a sibling, or a child. Attending the funeral service itself, however, that's slightly different. These are generally designed for family members and close friends. If you can go, all the better. Do so, by all means. But I would not be one to push on that quite as hard. In this particular situation, with the 12-year-old, the grief of the family will, of course, be off the charts. And that itself, I would think, would be a compelling reason to attend the funeral service. All right, number two, in our attempts to comfort those grieving, we need to be careful to not say things that are simply not true, or say things that we don't have any way of knowing, one way or the other. You know, these sorts of speculations are not helpful, even if they may sound to be comforting. And this is a common problem. For instance, people tend to think that the pain could be eased if the death had a specific purpose. And so there's this compelling need to fill in that blank and offer that purpose. We will hear things like, God took Jimmy because he needed another angel in heaven. It's a very common thing to say. Or, God knows what is best. This is his will and we just need to trust him. Or, God caused this hardship in your life to make you a better person. I've even heard, think of all the people who will hear the gospel at the funeral tomorrow. We need to see hardships from an eternal perspective. Things along this line, looking for some purpose. As though God's people have some sort of mystical insight into God's mind and could presume to be the spokesperson for that. Well, the problem is, when we say things like this, we place the responsibility of the death on God himself. God then becomes the author of death. The one whom the grieving family are called to lean upon during this unbearable time of suffering is the very one who caused the suffering. How can they trust someone who kills their loved ones? Now, this morning, we are not going to take time to explore the theology of death, only to affirm that the Bible refers to death as an enemy. Death is the result of the fall. Good people die, bad people die, we all die. But God hates death and defeated death and through the death and did so through the death and resurrection of his own son. We do not soften the blow by suggesting that God wanted the person to die. We want the grieving family to draw near to God at this time, and they won't do that if they blame him. Number three, along this line, we can help by sharing in the pain of the suffering, but we have to realize that we cannot make that pain go away. We need to accept our limitations, and too many people think they can just fix it by saying something clever when trying to console the ones grieving. So back to our working example with the 12-year-old. People will say things like, you are still young, you can have more children, as though this one can be replaced, like a toaster. Or, good thing the other children, your other children weren't in that car, you can at least be thankful that you still have them, implying that this tragedy isn't that bad, it could have been a lot worse. Well, such statements and ones like it, of course, are designed to push the grief away. But actually, they have just the opposite effect, for they trivialize the life of the one who died. You know, in the minds of the grieving, they're going to be thinking, how could anyone possibly think that Jimmy could be replaced? Or how could anything could possibly be worse than this? If at the time of visitation, you know, I could meet everybody at the door, and my job would be to offer one piece of advice to everybody coming in, I would say this. Think carefully about what you're about to say. Think carefully about what you're going to say to this family. Don't try to be clever. Don't think that you will be able to remove their pain by a cheap and ridiculous cliche. Maybe McComb and Sons might offer me a job like that when I retire. I actually think that would be a good fit for me. The fact that you are there and that you care and that your love is made known, that is what's important. You know, I'm so very sorry. I simply can't imagine what you're going through. We love you, and you are in our prayers, and perhaps a hug. That's what's sufficient here. You can comfort them. You can comfort them in their pain. You can help bear the pain, but you cannot remove the pain. And oftentimes, in trying to remove the pain, you end up trivializing the reason for the pain. There is pain because something valuable has been lost. If you want to comfort them, show that this loss is painful to you as well. All right, number four. One way to comfort the grieving family is to share words of praise about the deceased. This is very appropriate and actually quite helpful. Conveying appreciation for certain admirable character traits that you found impressive, or for some act of selflessness that stood out, that struck you. You know, sharing specific examples of this would certainly bless the grieving family. A lot of people, unfortunately, they just don't know what to say. They feel awkward about their inability to offer comfort. And when the moment comes, they just end up rambling on and on about all sorts of things. You would be surprised how many people there with the family in front of the casket will bring up the subject of the weather. Speaking well of the deceased is always appropriate. Keep in mind that they do not necessarily want people to feel sorry for them. They want their loved one honored, the memory of him to be treasured. And so come to the time of visitation prepared to do just that. Think ahead of what you might say. Number five, along with honoring the deceased, honor the grieving family themselves. And here I'm talking about showing proper respect, something that our modern culture overall is unfortunately losing an appreciation for more and more. I don't want to sound demeaning, but actually a lot of our youth today really don't have a clue about how to show respect in any setting. At the funeral home, we have to really be on top of this. We have to be diligent, not sloppy. And we would need to be sensitive to the mood, to the environment, and to the purpose of the occasion. Sensitive to how we, in subtle ways, are being perceived by the grieving family. If we are there to comfort them, are we, in ways we may not realize, actually working against that? That's a question we kind of need to be asking ourselves. And so, for starters, I would say this. Dress appropriately. You know, it'd be silly to even say anything like this 20 years ago, but not today. Seriously, I'm startled by what I see people wear to the funeral home. I've seen guys come in with t-shirts that are beer commercials. Some folks look like they've just finished up slopping hogs in the barnyard. Well, maybe not quite that bad, but close to it. I've seen women who look like they are on their way to a job interview at Hooters or Showgirls. The immodesty I've seen, again, at funeral homes is nothing less than disturbing, shocking. You don't have to be the best dressed person in the room, but do show some discretion. T-shirts, ragged blue jeans, shorts, and other very casual attire is a statement. Whether you realize it or not, it is a statement. It says that the one who died isn't worth even taking the time to change clothes for. Now, I realize that there will be those who will say, well, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm not making any statement. I just want to be comfortable. Well, that may be the case. But that's not the point. The point is, it is a statement whether you realize it or not. It is how the grieving family sees it. That's the point. Along that line, honor the family by respecting the mood. And here I'm talking about the actual environment itself. These times of visitation obviously bring lots of people together. It's quite common, normal, to chit-chat with others, even, you know, either while standing in line or while hanging around afterwards. And that's perfectly fine. We all do that sort of thing. What isn't so fine is when chit-chat escalates into loud laughter. Be careful with this sort of thing. Respect the mood. Respect the occasion. The contrast is striking. We have a circle over here of four or five guys laughing out loud about how bad Bob did in a game of golf. And 15 feet away, members holding back tears of pain while others try to console them on the sudden and tragic death of their 12-year-old son. You know, a few soft chuckles in a conversation, you know, that's one thing. But I've seen funeral homes turn into a bunch of little parties scattered all over the room, everyone just having a grand old time. For the family, Well, their world has stopped. They could never see themselves ever laughing again over anything. An effective way to comfort them is to convey that things have for you, even if it's on a lesser degree, have stopped as well. All right, next one, number six, show some restraint when attempting to identify with them in their grief. Now, it's going to be natural, and almost everybody does it, is to tell the grieving family that you know what they are going through because you have lost a loved one as well. And that may be true to a certain degree, but be careful how far you take it. Losing a 12-year-old son in a sudden car accident is different than losing an 85-year-old grandmother who had been suffering from health issues for the past 7 years. Certainly both are painful, certainly both are difficult, but certainly both are not the same. Even if you lost someone really close to you, unexpectedly, it still isn't the same. Every situation is different. Every relationship with the deceased is different. Every grief is different. Don't assume nor try to convey that you know exactly what they are feeling. You don't. No one does. In fact, even parents who suffer the death of a child will grieve differently, will feel differently, which can often be a source of tension in their relationship. So don't try to, you know, don't cheapen things by claiming that you know exactly what they feel. I would think that a short statement like the following would be about as far as you would want to take something like this. You know, this is really a tough thing to go through. I've been down this road myself. My brother passed away a couple months ago. I'll be praying for you. But much more beyond that, and it could be quite unhelpful. I hear people ramble on and on with all the details of their mom's death, for instance, something that happened several years ago. They talk about how much they grieved during that time and how things haven't been the same since and how much they missed their mom and on and on. And you know, the family, they don't need to hear that right now. There's no comfort for them in that. In fact, it only wears them out. You know, this is their moment, not yours. Don't monopolize it in this way. And whatever you do, don't use the death of a pet to claim that you know how they feel. And yes, I'm sorry to say, people actually do this. Again, focus your words on memories about the deceased, speaking well of his or her character using actual examples. Let the family know how much you treasured their loved one. Convey how sorry you are that you will be praying for them during this dark and difficult time. Don't ramble on about small talk. Don't trivialize the death by trying to push the pain away. Don't spend a lot of time elaborating on your own experiences with grief. Dress appropriately and save the boisterous laughing for the next guy's night out. All right, this leads us to the next point, number seven. Some suffering is too great for words. Sometimes it is simply being there for them that ministers comfort. And here I am thinking of not just the visitation at the funeral home, but also in the days and weeks, months that follow. Job lost his flocks and herd, his servants, all his sons and daughters, and then broke out in painful sores from head to toe. In chapter 2, we read about his three friends who came to console him. And this is what they did. And I'll read verse 13. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word to him, because they saw how great his suffering was. Now we often scold these friends of Job for their counsel, but because they did say some things that were really off, but this they did do right. Some suffering is too great for words. Sometimes we just need to sit with them quietly. All right, number eight, ask questions. Questions give us the opportunity to offer comfort by listening. You don't need to you do not want to overdo it here, and some discretion, of course, would be needed, but questions are good, for they let the other person express what they feel, and it means a lot to know that what they feel is important to you. All right, and the last one now, number nine, and this is a good one to end on, it is this, it does not stop at the funeral. Life goes on for you and me and the rest of the world. Life goes on for them as well, but it will never be the same. And being sensitive to that fact means that we should never be apprehensive in talking to them about their loss. Very important. In fact, this is one of the most common complaints I hear. There's a tragic death in the family. People come out in droves offering their love and support at the funeral home. But then 2 weeks later, everyone seems to go out of the way to avoid bringing any of it up. There is this, let's not go there kind of thing that seems to always kick in. Perhaps it's because we don't want to raise something unpleasant that might upset them. Maybe it's because we don't know what we would say and it's just easier to avoid it. Whatever it is not only unhelpful, but it makes everything awkward and weird. Now, the challenge here is that sometimes those grieving will not want to talk about it, and other times they will. And so you'll need to, figure that out. If you take Jimmy's mom out for coffee and she mentions his name in the conversation, then jump on that. Don't run from it. Don't change the subject. Pursue it a little bit. For what it is worth, I have found certain questions useful. I might say something like, what's it been, 2 months now since Jimmy's funeral? And the response to that is often a clue on whether they want to talk about it or not. And then I might offer something up, might follow up with something like this. So tell me if you feel up to it. And all of this, what's been the most difficult thing for you? Or, what sorts of things are you going through that took you by surprise that you weren't expecting? I'm interested. If they want to talk about Jimmy, then that will become obvious in their answer. If they don't, then respect that and maybe try again at another time. But follow up after the funeral. Don't let the threat of weirdness keep you from the opportunity of ministering to them. Suffer with those who suffer. Mourn with those who mourn. Bear one another's burdens. Don't treat the death as a subject that is off limits. Be willing to go there when appropriate. Each year, there will be certain times that will be more difficult. Birthdays, Christmas, the anniversary of the death, and so on. Now, we need to be sensitive to this, perhaps reach out. This Christmas will be the first Christmas the Lunas will observe without Katie, and the Warrens without Pat, and the Weavers without Lois. It may be helpful to remember that Dave and Deanna's wedding anniversary, November 13th, is also the anniversary of Adeline's funeral 12 years ago. The holidays are opportunities for us to remind the bereaved that we have not forgotten their loved ones and have not forgotten them. And along that line, I'm kind of finishing up here on this note. It is, follow up on other ways as well. It's common to say at the funeral home, if there's anything I can do, call on me. And we mean well, our intentions are good and all that. But at the same time, we must realize that they probably will not call on us. If you really mean it, then take the initiative. Stop by and offer to rake the leaves, clean out the gutters, do the laundry, or take them out to dinner. Look for practical, tangible ways to stand with them and show your love and support. The weeks and months that follow are lonely. Look for ways to help ease that. Oftentimes, it's not so much that they need help raking leaves as it is that they need someone to rake leaves with.